Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith.
Yep.
I'm Kent.
I'm Nathan.
And we're talking about Nathan's book, Essential Faith.
Whoa. And been doing this too long, Kent.
Yeah. And then you can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah.
We've just started kind of doing some meta discussion. We're really just getting into the book just barely last few weeks. Last couple times, and we were talking about freedom.
Yeah, freedom's good.
Last time.
It's a marvelous thing.
As I recall. Yes. Nathan, where do you want to take us today?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Kent, where do you want to take us?
Well, you were talking about freedom from the ways of the world, and the gospel sets us free from the ways of the world, and you riffed on how that means we shouldn't do church in a worldly way.
Yeah.
You haven't yet got into some of the other aspects of freedom rescue. In your book, you talk about rescued from the corrupt society. You were talking about rescue from the corrupt society when you said we shouldn't do church in those old corrupt ways.
Right.
Because that's the corrupt society.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't yet talked about internal corruption so much.
Right.
I don't think.
Yeah.
There may be something else I'm missing.
Oh, it's good. It's good. You know, and the challenge sometimes in doing this is when you become a Christian egghead, you get a little disconnected from everybody else, I guess, or the world, the people out there. And then when you get to be an old Christian egghead, you're even more distanced, you know. And so it there's a challenge, I think, for those of us on maybe this side of several years and, you know, paradigm shifts and things like that, to kind of speak into a world that frankly is different than the one I grew up in, you know, and it's also the struggles and trials that people have and that they take as a matter of course are, they're hard to relate to sometimes, you know, because of certain things, you know, as you walk down this road a while. So,
talking past people, so it's a problem. You're like, you think you're being clear and they're like, they're using different categories,
right?
And they're not hearing you right.
Well, that, and I think that, I don't want to answer questions that people aren't asking in their day-to-day life as we talk about this book, you know. But sometimes I don't know what those questions are, you know, what people are actually struggling with. And maybe they don't know that they're struggling or something like that. I think that right now in our world, and I mentioned this word, I think, last time, that people are overwhelmed.
Yeah.
The world is a very big place, and a small place. You know, as we have this window on everything, you know, I feel like there's been this really startling rise in anxiety, depression, especially among younger folks, and certainly, you know, life, I don't think, is any harder in terms of the actual challenges, maybe somewhat, and we could talk about, you know, the systems and how they've changed over time. But, you know, especially as say young adults are facing this world, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a perception, I think, of everybody out there is doing it better than you are, you know, that the, you are up against forces and systems that are stronger than you are, that you cannot possibly overcome, that you're going into a systems that are beyond you, the deck stacked against you, especially if you do not, you know, come from privilege. Maybe it's up to you to define who you are from scratch, and that the world is watching, that you have to be truly unique in a way that catches everyone's attention, but you're not allowed to be weird, or at least if you are weird, you cannot be weird in a way that the world disapproves of, right? And if the world disapproves of the way that you are weird, then there's something wrong with the world and you're going to have to change that, right? You're really under assault, I think, by an established group of forces that are coming down on you, and that those forces really are—they're destroying you. I just perceive like there's a search for identity, I think, in the world, mm-hmm. and that people are they're both pressured to define who they are and to know who they are as an individual, but also to be accepted and celebrated as that individual, you know. And so that's a challenge. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could begin to take on kind of that profile of being overwhelmed by the world and what has changed. Because I think what's ultimately and fundamentally wrong with everything is that whether implicitly or explicitly, people are taking on the job of God. They can't, you know, we can't help ourselves. Somebody has to do the job. And if we don't believe that someone's doing the job, but the job can't be left undone. So, you know, you may not know anything about flying airplanes, but if you happen to walk by the cockpit in a plane that you're on and no one's sitting there, you know,
you're going to try
at least. Right. And, you know, what will that do to your internal self? Right. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I'd feel overwhelmed.
Right? And stuck between two impossible choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't fly this plane. And you can't not fly this plane.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So what do you do? And I think that's how people see their lives. And it's very difficult. You know, young people nowadays, and we've mentioned how there's less belief. And without this sense of this divine authority out there, I do think that one thing that's going to come with it is being overwhelmed, being depressed, being anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
we weren't made to operate as God.
Right. Right. And so if you want to know why is faith an essential,
mm-hmm.
you know, 'cause I think that sadly, most people would think, and I admit in the book, that religion often is just this add-in, this thing that people take on because they can't handle life. And it is a set of learned behaviors, almost through some kind of classical conditioning or whatever, you mm-hmm. know, that has passed into lore and tradition to the point that it's being a culture. So I think it's fair, people who are critics of religion could say, well, you know, these religious practices came from somebody who did not know how to attribute cause and effect, and they misassigned a cause to an effect, and then they taught their children that misattribution, and they that passed on,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's easy for people to feel like religion or faith or whatever is certainly not essential and probably isn't even helpful. You know, if you're flying this plane, right? And let's say someone comes on the radio and they say, hey, it's going to be fine. You just need to let go of the wheel. Right? I've taken it by remote. You just take your hands off.
Uh-huh.
If you keep on holding on, then you're going to counteract. And I'm trying to do. I need you to just trust me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. Now that may feel like a big ask, right?
Mm-hmm.
You feel like, well, the stakes are here. They're not over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what your intentions are, what you want to do, what your capabilities are, all of that. You can't mm-hmm. see me. You can't see from my perspective, all of that. Right. At any rate, so speaking into someone's life and saying, hey, you don't have to be overwhelmed like this, right? Life doesn't have to be too big for you. You're taking on things that are not your responsibility. So at any rate, I think when we say essential faith, that really making the case that this isn't something, it's not essential for church. It's not essential for religiosity. This isn't a good way just for people who are already Christians to be better Christians. I think it is. Maybe it's the only way to be Christian. But I think that it answers these fundamental questions
mm-hmm.
of life.
Your claim is that this is for that the gospel is for this life.
Yes.
Salvation is rescue from forces at work to destroy you now.
Right. Right. And I want to make the case that, you know, if you're out there listening or you know someone who needs to hear this, everybody already knows that something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that they've learned to cope in one way or another. You know, and to me that's dishonest. It's a dishonest way to live, to be in this form of denial to whatever degree, right? And I've mentioned before, you know, the atheist's attempt at finding significance or creating significance, which is folly, right? It's dishonest. Most of the time, I think most people think we should be honest, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the difficulty with that is that honesty is it's not very utilitarian. You know, we learn to lie for pragmatic reasons for the most part, unless someone's just a pathological liar. Most lies are very practical, right?
It's not very useful to say, honestly, there is no meaning to mm-hmm. this life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it didn't help. You know, Nietzsche's assessment of humankind, the social dynamics, didn't help humanity a whole lot. I mean, if you follow that mind stream out and you see it's greater products, you know, I mean, is it fair? Is it fair to say that, you know, Hitler is the intellectual child of Nietzsche? You know, I think it is. I don't think Nietzsche would have an indictment on a way to indict Hitler. If you just take his principles and you said, I'm a nihilist ethicist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm going to use this nihilism, to construct a ethical matrix, and I'm going to test whether that matrix is effective or, you know, helpful by now reflecting on Nazi Germany, right? And what resources does this ethical standard give me to indict that mentality and that event in history? But what would it have done if people had understood it? How would it have helped to stop that?
Right.
Right. And I do not believe that it has those resources. You know, I think it instead would endorse those things. I mean, this idea of mm-hmm. casting off morality. Now, I would also say you should cast off morality as a construct, you know. But I think that, and that's what's scary about the gospel, because we think, well, without it, now we're back, right? We're back there, and we're scared of our fellow man. We're scared of ourselves. But what we need a worldview that gives us the ethical resources to build an effective community that we want to be a part of, right? But we also need something that will allow us to flourish as an individual, right? And to be purely and truly authentic as ourselves, to come from behind all of the veneers that we've had to create to exist. And that veneer is, I think, the big lie. So I'm wandering a little bit, so let me narrow down maybe on one thing.
Okay.
So how to confront this sense of self, okay? How can I be truly me? Maybe that's something to begin to help someone get out from being overwhelmed, is because, you know, the balance of the dynamics of this world, right, is that everyone is alone, ultimately. If you are conforming to external pressures, okay, that you, those pressures will eventually make you do something that is against your core being, who you really are, right?
Mm-hmm.
It'll do it sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you become at least two people. You know, there's an inner self and an outer self. I think it's why preachers' kids tend to struggle more, right?
Because you're conforming to ministry. Dad's world,
mm-hmm.
but you have your own inner world, your right. private self.
Right, yeah. I mean, just because you're, you know, your parents, your family's in ministry doesn't mean you're not going to face the same temptations as other people.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have the same struggles, but you're not allowed to have those struggles or admit those struggles like somebody else would. And, you know, I think we see this kind of damage because, and if someone, you know, doesn't realize this, I think they're being dishonest, right? That this need to have a public self, you know, and if that public is actually even in your own household, your family, your spouse, they're the public that you're performing for. And to some degree, that's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're truly alone, right? I mean,
you can't be known alone in the sense of your true self can't be known.
Right, right. And if that's the case, then how will you confront these forces that are continuing to work against you, right? So, and this is what in the book I call the disintegration of the self. And I'm talking about one particular aspect of this disintegration of the self, and that is the disintegration into public and private self.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll talk about other ways that the self is disintegrated, but I think in our world today, these forces are more acute. I think if you perceive yourself to be alone, what happens is that you build up a perception of somebody else that's untrue as you interact with their public self, right? And you begin to come under this influence that tells you if they really knew who you were, they would cast you out. They would hate you, right? They would string you up if they knew who you really were. So now they're the friend of your public self, but they're the enemy of your private self.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have around are frenemies.
Mm-hmm.
People who are making you perform for their benefit to keep them around. You're being extorted by them somehow. You know, that their acceptance is conditional on your conforming to what they would like you to be, right? And, you know, this happens, I think, a lot of times, again, in religious households. What you get are young people who feel that they can't talk to their parents about their struggles. And a lot of that has to do with a real or perceived litany of rules. Gets back to that thing.
This gets back to the problem of religion and of law. Mm-hmm. When Christianity is understood as rules to follow, which is law,
right. Mm-hmm.
Then it's deadly.
Mm-hmm. Right, because laws, the way they work, so if you violate a capital prohibition in the government, right, you commit treason or you murder somebody in a premeditated way, something that really in most of the states in the U.S. would get you a death sentence, right, and you're on trial. Now, when you... I have this nightmare, you know, that I'm under suspicion. Maybe I'm about to be arrested for something and somehow I actually did it. Now, you know, I'm just, but when somebody who's really been brought up under, you know, serious charges and they go before the judge and the judge asks for their plea, what do you think their plea's going to be?
Not guilty.
Right. Right. Okay. Not guilty. Right. Why?
I don't want to die.
Right. Yeah. Now, we're not encouraged that, hey, if you would just be honest,
mm-hmm.
if you would just come out, we can help you. I mean, is that ever the offer? You know, we obviously something's gone wrong in your history. Mm-hmm. You know, if you would just admit, we could get you into some rehab, get you mm-hmm. into some anger management therapy. You know, I mean, it'll take a few years, but I think we can help you if you'll just admit that you have a problem.
Right. No, it's not reparative like right. that. No.
Right. So whether you did it or not, whether the smoking gun's in your hand at that moment, you're still going to say not guilty, right? Mm-hmm. By reason of whatever, but you're hoping your lawyer is good enough, and you know, and hopefully you'll have the resources to pay that lawyer. And it's immaterial, but we don't get up and say, you know, my client, Your Honor, my client, it's absolutely did this thing, and he's deeply sorry, and he would like to make amends, and he would like to forge a new path in life, and here's, you know, what we're going to do, and also he's got this history of being a relatively decent person until this moment, and I mean, we could ask for that to some degree in terms of sentencing, but for the most part, it doesn't matter. You can't compensate for breaking a law. That's the whole point, is that once the law is broken, you have to confront the transgression. The transgression has to be dealt with, right? And that's how we understand the way society controls the behavior of its members, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a legal system, if there's a God out there watching and waiting for you to transgress a law, right, and that all of his prohibitions are capital offenses, you know, you spend a lot of time trying to build defenses, right, trying to seem not guilty, and mostly in the court of your own mind. And all of those things lead to a lot of this dysfunction that I'm talking about.
You're trying to suppress this guilt.
Right. You're suppressing the guilt, but you're also afraid of being discovered, or maybe even afraid of that your behavior will somehow be attributed to a fundamental flaw, an irreparable indictment on your character that just says this person is a liar, right? A murderer, a sicko. Right, mm-hmm. that there's a pathology there, okay, mm-hmm. and that's almost inescapable that our deeds would define us, and even as I say it, I think, well, it couldn't be otherwise, because if it is, we will not hold people accountable for what they do, right? If your deeds don't define you, how can you be held accountable? Now. The problem is that in my inner world, I know me better than anybody else, but I also have this thing called attribution bias. Well, I did that because I was tired. I did that because I was just flustered, right? And so, but they wouldn't see it that way. If they knew, they wouldn't give me the opportunity to really explain, right? And that intensifies this. Because now I begin to have these conversations, you know, I play out, what if I did tell them, you know, and all this, and now I'm really in this adversarial relationship with the people that are closest to me. So all of that makes us alone. And so my contention would be that the gospel, when properly understood without these legal prescriptives on top, gives us the resources to be our true self. And even to face the court of public opinion, whatever that public might be. Again, it could be your spouse, could be your children, could be your neighbors, and certainly other church members and stuff. So if I am free from conformity, right? Mm-hmm. Let's just go with that one. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for this public-private self? What do you think?
Well, the wall can come down between the public self and the private self if I'm free from managing other people's impressions of me.
Yeah.
I can be one self.
Mm-hmm. Why? How does the gospel, give me one way that the gospel gives you the resources to be the true you?
I'm not afraid of what they might do to me because God is greater and he loves me. So I don't have to lie. I don't have to manipulate people. I can, as appropriate, admit my wrongs. I can just seek, I guess I'm just here to, I guess I'm just here to help and serve now, mm-hmm. not to yeah. manipulate and control now.
Right. Right. I, you know, Paul, that whole Romans 8 thing of, you know, where he says, who will bring a charge against God's elect? Mm-hmm. Right now. I think that being accepted now, that acceptance will only affect my behavior to the degree that I believe it. Right? Mm-hmm. So we get kind of to the title of the book.
Faith.
Right, right. This is why it's everything. Mm-hmm. If much of what's wrong with people, much of the pain that they suffer, but also the pain they sow back into the world, because that suspicion of others, even those who are closest to me, is it's not going to remain private. It's going to come out in passive aggressiveness, right? It's going to come out in neuroses and particular habits, behaviors. It's going to come out in blame shifting, accusations and lies, criticism. All these things are going to be, I'm going to cough them back into the relationships that I think are besieging me and extorting me, mm-hmm. right? Even though the other person may just be, you know, haplessly going on thinking everything's fine, you know. But as a person is able to accept their acceptance and accept it so radically that they can be seen, you know, I think that's why therapy helps, even regardless of kind of who your therapist is. You know, your therapist may just get in the way, honestly, but having someone who's paid to know you confidentially, mm-hmm. you know, that in and of itself probably, you know, has a ton of positive benefit, just to have that one person, that one confidant. You know, maybe that's why the Catholic Church came up with confession, that and having dirt on people to control them. I don't know, you know, but and that's why I think John in 1 John 1 tells us that we need to walk in the light, and by that he means to confess our sins. Why? Because only that way can we have fellowship with one another, he says, and the blood of Christ washes that away. So the gospel tells us we're accepted. It also, and this is, I think this is key, this is critical, it also does away with transgressions.
Yeah, so most people who hear you say the gospel does away with transgressions, I think they will think you mean what I think you mean. On the surface, I think you mean, okay, the gospel like delivers us from sins, from sinning. But I mm-hmm. think you meant instead, because I've read your book. See, people, you should read the book.
Right, read the book.
buy the book. It's on Amazon. That's right. What you meant was, the gospel does away with transgressions in the sense that the gospel removes the law.
Right.
And transgression has to do with laws.
Right. Yes. And, you know, a lot of times we just think of sin as this one thing, and that would be, we equate sin and transgression. Our whole gospel is is based on jurisprudence and a legal metaphor, you know. You violated laws. You were guilty. Jesus came and paid the capital punishment for your violations, whatever they were. Obviously, you know, just you lied to your mom that time about, you know, whatever. Now you should go to hell and be destroyed, right? But thankfully, Jesus died on the cross and he paid for that, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I think our minds don't accept, they might accept in the moment that gospel that says, you have incurred legal guilt. Christ came and paid the legal punishment for your legal guilt. And in having done so, now you are exonerated from your, when you accept that he's paid that, you're exonerated from your capital offenses. Okay, so there's this moment in the courtroom when you're declared innocent and you're rejoicing and you walk out of there and everything's great until the next day when someone says, do I look fat in this dress? And, right?
And you lie.
And you lie. You lie. And now all of a sudden you're like, am I going to go back in there? Am I going to say, hey, judge, you remember that thing that you you know, forgave me for yesterday, because that guy died on a cross. Could we do that again? Right? Sure. Click, you know, the next day, you know, hey, did you get that project done? Oh, you know, Jenkins, he was on that and he was supposed to, yeah. Hey, remember, Judge, remember that thing? Mm-hmm. Right. After a while, you just start to say, you know, I don't think he's going to keep forgiving me for all this. You know, this going back and groveling every day is just getting old, man. It's wearing me out. And I don't feel a ton of hope. And I don't feel like this is great news. I just keep having to now come clean every day. Right. What do I do? So I think a lot of times when we leave the law in place, when in Christianity we what we've done is we keep that legal metaphor and we just add to it, you know, an indefinite litany of exonerations, let's mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. based on Christ's death on my behalf. Okay. That when we do that, I think we have an impoverished gospel. It doesn't work out well in my history. It hasn't worked out well as I've seen other people. We either become desensitized to our sin to the point that now it just isn't bad. It's not that bad. You know, it could just be forgiven. You know, it's not a big deal. Right. Or we just start to feel like I'm tired of being on the in the dock all the time. You know, maybe the problem isn't me. Maybe the problem is this God that expects more than I can do, right? We're going to find fight or flight, you know what I'm saying? We're going to have to, at some point, we're going to just start justifying our actions again. We're going to start taking on those same old things if these rules remain in place. And I think that they have. So what are we to do, right? The reason I say the transgression is done away, or you know, trespass, or however you want to frame it, where it's the violation of a prescriptive prohibition or requirement. Okay, mm-hmm. That dynamic is just—it's a secondary definition of sin, I would say, right? So. And Paul makes that case in Romans 5, where he says, look, Adam transgressed.
He broke a commandment.
Right. And this one transgression brought guilt and death on all of his progeny. So he's the federal head, we would say, right? He's the one who represents humankind in this opportunity to trust God, right? Mm-hmm. And his mistrust is expressed in a violation of a command, right? And so Adam committed the first sin, I guess, or maybe Eve did. But anyway, Adam he's the one who transgressed in that he received this prohibition personally from God, right? So he transgresses. Now, Paul makes the case that from Adam to Moses, the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, there were no transgressions.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, sin ruled right? people during that
in
time.
Death. Sin ruled in death mm-hmm. from Adam to Moses, even though none had transgressed. Mm-hmm. Okay. So sin seems to be something other than a violation of a prohibition mm-hmm. or the neglect of a command, you know. So what is it, you know? Paul seems to say this exists whether somebody is, you know, somebody's violated a rule or whether they have a rule to violate at all. So if you think by my saying there are no rules that I'm going off the rails, you know, Paul first said humanity lived without rules for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And sinned without rules.
And sinned without rules. So it's not like rules are the whole problem, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, that you know, this... God says that this was given so that these transgressions would increase, right?
The law was given. So that right. transgressions would right. increase.
So God is, transgressions are not only not the definition of sin, but they're also not the big deal to God that we think they are. You know, that God's not, you know, it's not like, hey, everything's awesome, everything's great, but if I told you not to do that, now you did it. Oh, okay, now I'm mad, mm-hmm. right? You didn't know before, it's fine, but now I told you. Now I'm mad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, God knowing that there would be millions of transgressions as a result of giving the covenant law, gave the covenant law so that those transgressions would occur.
Weird.
What?
That's right? Weird.
Right? Really flies in the face of kind of this Puritan version of Christianity that I think we've inherited here in the U.S., okay? And, you know, Paul's not alone in saying that sin existed apart from the law. If you look at Genesis chapter 4 in the incident with Cain and Abel.
Sin is crouching at your door.
It wants to have you.
It wants to have you. You must master it.
Right. Notice that God didn't say, and remember, don't kill your brother. Remember, thou shalt not kill.
Right. That commandment hadn't been given yet.
And in fact, when Cain does kill Abel, Cain is not subject to the penalty of the law.
Mm-hmm.
But as God, you know, God says,
I'm going to put a mark on you so that people won't kill you.
Right. Yeah.
Isn't that what he says?
Yes. Right. Right. And now you're going to have to leave the land. Mm-hmm. Why are you leaving the land? Well, because it's accepted your brother's blood and that there's you've spiritually polluted this region that was supposed to be a holy place. I mean, Cain understands that the near regions of Eden are closer to God's presence than outside. Now, he seems to also be afraid of people who live outside that environment as mm-hmm. well, and that gets to a whole thing about how we understand the creation narratives, but that's neither here nor there at the moment. It's just that Cain is banished from God's presence, at least his experience of God's presence, mm-hmm. right? And for him, he says, my punishment is too great. mm-hmm. You know, but you can see that these are all that these are the dynamics of sin with no prohibition against murder
mm-hmm.
and no penalty directly for murder. Consequences, yes, you know, mm-hmm. but not the score needs to be settled. You killed him, therefore you shall be killed. That comes after Noah comes off the ark, you know, and so maybe Paul's a little bit wrong, but, you know, after Noah comes off the ark, there's this requirement. It's really not a prohibition against murder. It's more of a requirement that those who kill people should themselves be killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So trying to keep violence in check. I mean, what was the problem before? You know, why does the flood come? Right? Violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are we keeping violence in check? You know, maybe exterminating the violent seems to be all we have, right? Now the gospel comes in. And instead of just saying, you know, this is your get out of hell free pass, or this is an eraser, you know, this is clean up on aisle U, you know, that what the gospel does, in, I think, instead, and to a greater degree, is that the law itself has been wiped away. You know, as far as we're concerned, court is no longer in session, but also the courtroom has been closed and emptied and burned to the ground, and there's no way to go back. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just done. And I think that it's very freeing if people can grasp that that's true. And if we can grasp that that's true, then we can be more honest with ourselves, with other people. I still think it's a journey. Just becoming honest is in and of itself a journey for people. You know, we're getting over this stuff. And some of the stuff we're getting over wasn't just dysfunction. It was function. You know, we've got to get over how we functioned, how the world functions. That's pretty radical.
No law, and the world functions by law, by mm-hmm. crime and punishment, and it still does.
Right.
But we've been, like you've said before, we've been transferred. We've been raised to another place, a new echelon,
mm-hmm.
and so we're not in that system anymore.
Right. Right. And that is not so that we can live these self-indulgent, immoral lives, right? Paul gets to his point, you know, in Romans 5, he says that You know, just as sin reigned through death, you know, grace might also reign through righteousness, right? That the law really, it gave sin a sword to not only bring this bifurcation of the self, which is, I think, happens whether there's a law or not, right? But it certainly is intensified by the law. But then, you know, now sin has this thing that says, look what you did. You know, so not only does sin want to, is it crouching at the door and does it want to have us, but it also wants to hold over us the fact that we succumbed, right? Or mm-hmm. the fear that we're going to again, or all these things that push us into isolation, make us so dysfunctional and neurotic and everything else, right? But Paul, you know, Paul says that, hey, you know, you're not under law. Transgression's been done away. And I think he knows the significance of what he's saying. I mean, he's speaking to people who live in the Capitol when he's writing that. It's like, you know, writing to people in Washington, D.C. and saying law is no longer, law is over as a principle, right? And they're just like, what are we doing here, right? So he's writing to people in the seat of Roman law and jurisprudence and saying this isn't a thing. And then he asks the question, you know, his invisible interlocutor asks him, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? Right?
Just like law caused sin to increase.
Right.
Should we go on sinning so that grace may increase?
Right. Well, and I mean, people see law as the thing that, you know, inhibits sin. We don't see law as the thing that facilitates sin, right? So to think that the law has been done away, now you're saying, you know, let's just go nuts. All bets are off, right?
Yeah.
And so he goes, you know, he goes into, I think everything from Romans 6 through Romans 8 is answering that question, okay? And maybe we can't go into all the details of it right now, but he gets in, I think, one helpful breadcrumb along the way as we move through Romans 6 through 8. But in Romans 6:14, he says, "For sin shall no longer be your master, because you are not under law, but under grace." Right? So what's the point of doing away with law?
So that we will no longer be mastered by sin.
Right. Yes. Why? Because the problem with law is it just doesn't allow us to go back. It doesn't have any remediating function. You know? So that people are going to sin is a given. Right? Mm-hmm. And so how is the law, since the law can't prevent sin, it can only indict us once we have sinned. I mean, it can prohibit sin. And there's a degree to which in society, I think it can reduce the amount of actual overt sinning if you have a good law and it's well enforced. Obviously, there are going to be fewer major infractions happening out there, but ultimately sin as this defiance against, you know, this rebellion against God, this violation of the a person's own conscience, you know, it can't really stop that from taking place. The best it can do is just indict that and to discourage it from somebody else doing it, right? So how do we, on the individual level, how is somebody now to live, right? How can we live authentically? So all that to say, once law is done away, what my experience has been that once law has been done away, really in our minds, as we really begin to internalize this by faith, and we decriminalize human behavior, I mean, that's really what we're saying, mm-hmm. okay? That the instinct to gossip, right? The instinct to criticize or to vilify another person, it goes away as well over time, right? Because now we assume people are going to do things that are wrong, right? We also assume that that doesn't define them and that they have been bought and paid for, right? That we begin to assume these things of somebody else, okay? That their performance, their previous or recent performance does not declare or set their destiny at all, right? And so if we really begin to imbibe these truths of the gospel, what we can do is, and one way we know we're getting better at this, is when someone commits some sort of an offense, that our first instinct is to care for that person, pray for that person, hold them up, encourage them to sow into them, to warn them. I mean, I do think that they are in some sort of danger.
Yeah, like God warned Cain.
Right. They're in danger, right? And so if someone's in danger, what should we do, right? Instead of saying they are the danger, we say they're in danger. We understand that from the perspective of the gospel, okay? Now, they may have hurt another person, right? And that person is also in danger because when we get hurt, there's a whole other set of toxins, I guess, that come in that on the whole become the same kinds of stuff, right? So that person's in danger as well. But what the main thing that needs to happen is full transparency and unconditional acceptance as we move forward with concern for all parties. So let's apply this to the recent kerfuffle in the Baptist church.
The recent, which recent kerfuffle?
Yeah, this was probably about 3 or 4 years ago. So when I say recent, I'm talking in geologic time. You know, after you get so old, you talk in geologic time. from a geologic perspective, this is recent. The Baptist Church had done that evaluation, that study. They realized that there were lots of offenses, lots of victims, that, all the stuff abuse had been swept under the rug. And that the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention did not want this report released. Do you remember why they didn't want it released?
Protecting the reputation of the organization and the funding, the money.
Fiduciary responsibilities.
I think they did say that.
That was the official reason. Mm-hmm. Now, evaluate that from the gospel perspective. Right.
Well, this just circles. This goes back to some of our earlier comments. If I'm free, if we're free from what people will do to us, what people will think, what people will say, we're free to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And if it's the right thing to be transparent, admit wrongdoing, so that there can be healing and repentance and restoration,
right,
then we get to do that. Free from any kind of fear of retribution.
Right, right. What happens to us is we think that we've been commanded to reach the lost, or to care for the hurting, feed the hungry, all these things, right? But we think that's on us, that the gospel really revolves around these outputs.
Mm-hmm.
So you're Ravi Zacharias.
Oh, now you're changing the subject. Right. Okay. Yeah. Now we're at Ravi. Okay.
Right, right. But it's the same dynamic.
Yeah.
It's always the same dynamic. It's you click on the wrong link. You discover that you like that. Nobody can find out about it. Clear your browser history. Still thinking about it. Shame, prayer, temptation, sin, right? Isolation, downward spiral. Now you say something inappropriate to your assistant. Mm-hmm. For the sake of the ministry, she doesn't report that, right? Now you begin to think, well, maybe this wasn't bad, what I did,
Maybe I need a break. Maybe right, I deserve it.
Right. All this goes on and on. I mean, Robbie purportedly said that, these by the time he was in, basically, had gotten indulging in all these terrible things, had basically come to the point where he'd said, "This is my reward from God for all of the good that I've done for His kingdom." Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just like, how do you get there, right? But it comes through really a feeling of responsibility for the spiritual well-being of other individuals, for an assessment of the value of an organization or something like that. We can't release this report because look at all the good we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And that's in the place of God. That's right. We've got to manage things.
Right. Right. And you see that if we understand that on the micro, that the gospel is this being set free, that this requirement for authenticity and transparency, that's the whole point, that if we're not ministering that, we're not ministering from that, we're not participating, no matter how much good you say you're doing, we're really not helping anybody or anything. But if so, let's just say, rewind it a little bit, right? Just go back, go back to the 80s when these pastors were committing these infractions, okay? And let's say the pastor's discovered, somebody brings an allegation. If the leadership's thinking, we're just here to obey the gospel, just to be who we are, right? This guy's in danger. And the people under him are in danger, right? And that danger is acute. It's critical right now.
Mm-hmm.
The only way forward for him is to be honest, right? And the only way forward for the victim is for there to be an admission, right? And that whatever happens with that church or whatever is in God's hands.
Mm-hmm.
If we truly have faith as the cardinal. Mm-hmm. Virtue, right? Now we can trust God enough to do the right thing without trying to weigh what's right or wrong. If you have the time, there's a show on Netflix. I don't endorse everything about it. I think I may have mentioned. I think it's called Inside Man.
Hmm.
Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. Maybe you mentioned it.
I think it's called Inside Man. It's got David Tennant of Doctor Who fame and Stanley Tucci. In it. Mm-hmm. So that's enough to get you to watch it right mm-hmm. there. And it sets up this dilemma. So there's a guy, he's an Anglican rector, and through a series of foibles and misunderstandings, it looks likely that his son is going to be falsely accused of viewing child pornography.
Mm.
And
the rector's
mm-hmm. son, and it's discovered by this by the son's tutor.
Mm-hmm.
And the tutor is like, "Oh my gosh!" And she's about to walk out the door, and he knows she's going to alert the authorities to this discovery. What do you do?
Well,
there you go.
there's our cliffhanger, because it's time for us to close.
Yep.
Oh my goodness, we ran out of time. You'll have to come and listen next time.
There you go.
And we'll continue the discussion then. Thanks, everybody. You can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Stay tuned for more.